Today, well, we're tackling a huge one. Consciousness. What is it? And maybe more to the point, where is it? Because we all kind of assume it's just up there in the brain.
Right. That's the default. But the research we looked at, it suggests, well, the whole body might be playing a role. It gets pretty surprising.
It really does. It's a massive question. Stumped people for centuries. So our mission today is to follow the evidence, see where it actually leads.
Yeah, and it's tricky because pinning down consciousness is like trying to grab smoke. Even the experts, philosophers, neuroscientists, they don't fully agree on a definition.
Okay, so let's start there then, the basics. When we dug through the literature, what's the sort of core idea of consciousness they kept coming back to?
Well, the simplest definition is an individual's unique subjective awareness. Awareness of themselves and, you know, the world around them.
Unique awareness. Okay. Yeah. But what makes it so complex? There were a few key features mentioned.
Exactly. Three main things really stand out. First, there's subjective experience. Fancy term is qualia.
Qualia.
It's that private what it feels like thing. Like my experience of seeing the color blue or the specific way my coffee tastes this morning. It's personal.
You can describe blue, but you can't transfer the feeling of seeing it.
Precisely. Can't transfer it. Second feature. Intentionality. Consciousness is always about something.
Meaning.
Meaning your thoughts aren't just floating randomly.
Yeah.
They relate to things, objects, ideas, people. If you feel happy, you're usually happy about something specific.
Right. Okay. Got it. And the third one. This is the big one, maybe.
Yeah. This is self-awareness or metacognition. Thinking about thinking.
Being aware that you are aware.
Exactly. It's that ability to reflect on your own mental states. And that, of course, is what makes studying consciousness so incredibly difficult. The thing doing the studying is the thing being studied.
Right. A bit of a loop there.
A big loop. So understanding consciousness means we also have to look at what it's not. We need to talk about the unconscious mind.
Okay. The iceberg beneath the surface.
That's a great way to put it. The conscious bit is just the tip. Underneath is the massive unconscious mind.
And we're not just talking Freud here, like hidden desires and stuff. What's the modern take?
Well, Freud's ideas about repressed wishes and drives were influential, sure. But the modern scientific view sees the unconscious mostly as the realm of automatic processes. Things happening outside our awareness, it still shape how we act.
So less about hidden conflicts, more about efficiency.
Exactly. It's the brain's and body's efficiency engine. Think about breathing or your heart beating. You don't consciously manage that, thankfully.
Right. It just runs in the background.
It runs. And it's not just basic biology. Think about skills you've practiced a lot, like riding a bike or maybe driving a route you take every day.
You're on autopilot sometimes. Your mind's elsewhere.
Totally. Your conscious mind is free, planning dinner or whatever.
Thanks.
While the unconscious handles the driving. But it's doing even more. It's constantly filtering all the information coming in from your senses.
Filtering? How so?
It decides what's important enough to bother your conscious mind with. Most stuff just gets handled automatically, below the radar. It has to. Otherwise, you'd be overwhelmed.
So the unconscious is like a gatekeeper for our attention.
A very efficient gatekeeper. And this is where things like implicit bias can operate or priming.
Primeval.
Yeah, we're seeing or hearing one thing makes it easier to think of related things, even if you don't consciously make the connection. It's all about making fast associations, maximizing efficiency for, well, survival mostly. Consciousness gets the edited highlights.
Okay, so the unconscious is doing a ton of work. Let's go back to the brain itself, the place we usually think of as the headquarters.
Right, the physical structure. We know the basics, two hemispheres, roughly symmetrical, four main lobes. Frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal. Each with specialized functions, but crucially, they all work together.
They're integrated. And specific parts do specific jobs, like the amygdalae.
Yes, the amygdalae are key for processing emotions, particularly fear, and involved in decision-making, too. And then there's the cerebellum.
Which we usually associate with movement and balance.
We do, but it's packed. Mm. It has over half the brain's neurons.
Over half? Wow.
Yeah. And we now know it's involved in cognitive functions, too. Mm. Attention, language, things like that. It's much more than just motor control.
But you said it's not just about the parts. It's about how they connect the networks.
Exactly. That's the big shift in neuroscience. It's less about isolated areas and more about interconnected networks that activate together for different tasks.
Okay, so what are the main networks we should know about?
There are three major ones. First, the default mode network, the DMN.
default mode.
Yeah, it's active when your mind is wandering, daydreaming, thinking about the past or future, reflecting on yourself, kind of your internal chatterbox when you're not focused on the outside world.
Makes sense. And the opposite.
That would be the central executive network, or CEN. This one lights up when you need to focus, concentrate on task, solve a problem, make decisions, goal-directed stuff.
DMN for internal, CEN for external focus. Got it. Is there a third?
Yes, and it's really important. The salience network, the SN. Think of it as the switcher.
The switcher.
Uh-huh. It monitors both what's happening internally and externally and helps shift your attention between the DMN and CEN based on what's most important or salient at that moment. It's also heavily involved in emotional regulation.
Ah, so when you snap out of a daydream because someone calls your name, that's the salience network kicking in.
That's likely the SN detecting an important external cue and shifting your brain's resources. Now, if we had to point to one area as the sort of traditional seat of consciousness, the command center.
It would be the cortex.
The cerebral cortex, yeah.
Yeah.
Specifically the prefrontal cortex. That's the bit right at the front, highly developed in humans and great apes. It handles planning, complex decision-making, personality, all those executive functions.
It's the CEO of the brain.
Kind of. But even the CEO, as we're learning, might spend a lot of its time listening.
Listening. Okay, that leads us nicely into this other fascinating concept, how we sense things. We know about sensing the outside world.
Right, exteroception. Sight, sound, touch, smell, taste. Sensing what's out there.
But there's also sensing what's in here, right?
Exactly. Interoception. That's sensing your internal bodily state. Things like hunger, thirst, your heartbeat, gut feelings, pain, temperature, bladder fullness, even the physical sensations tied to emotions.
And the sources said interoception is often fuzzier, less precise.
Generally, yes. You know exactly where a sound is coming from, usually. But an internal feeling, like anxiety, might just be a vague, hard-to-pinpoint sense of unease in your chest or stomach.
Okay, so we have these internal signals, sometimes vague. We have the unconscious processing things rapidly. How does the brain put it all together so quickly? This is where that prediction theory came in, right?
Yes. This is a really key idea. Mm-hmm. The brain isn't just passively waiting for information to arrive and then reacting.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly predicting what sensory input it's going to receive.
Predicting, like guessing.
Sort of. But based on past experience and the current context, it builds a model of the world, including your internal world, and anticipates what comes next. It uses specialized bits of the cortex, these cortical columns, to do this.
Why? Why predict instead of just reacting?
Speed and efficiency. If you wait for the full signal to arrive and process it from scratch every time, you're too slow. Predicting lets you prepare a response in advance. It's a huge survival advantage.
And this prediction thing explains some weird phenomena.
Absolutely. Think about the placebo effect. If you strongly believe a sugar pill will relieve your pain, your brain predicts pain relief. That prediction can actually cause physiological changes that do reduce the pain. The prediction shapes the reality.
Wow. And proofreading. Why is it so hard to spot typos in your own writing?
Same reason. Your brain knows what word is supposed to be there, so it predicts that word. When you glance at the page, the prediction is so strong that you literally see the correct word, even if there's a typo. Your brain skips over the error.
The prediction overrides the actual input. That's wild.
It is. And one fascinating article we read suggested that consciousness itself might emerge from this predictive process, specifically related to internal signals.
How so?
The idea is that consciousness begins with the brain interpreting its own predictions about your internal bodily state, hunger, safety, anxiety, whatever. Then it compares the prediction to the actual signals coming from the body via interoception.
And the feeling of me, my subjective awareness, comes from that comparison, the match or mismatch.
That's the hypothesis. That constant internal listening, predicting, and comparing generates our sense of self, our moment-to-moment experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain isn't just a commander barking orders.
It's more like a dedicated listener constantly tuning in to the body signals.
Exactly. And specific brain areas like the insula and certain brainstem nuclei
seem
really important for relaying and integrating this internal visceral information.
Okay, if the brain is listening so intently to the body, what else is it listening to? This takes us towards the idea of distributed intelligence, doesn't it?
It really does. This challenges the brain of soul commander idea most directly. We start finding intelligence, or at least complex processing, in unexpected places, like the gut.
The second brain. We hear that phrase a lot now.
And it's not just hype. The enteric nervous system, or ENS, lining your gut is incredibly complex. We're talking 200 to 600 million neurons.
That's a lot.
It's huge, comparable to the brain of a cat, some say. And crucially, the ENS can operate independently of the brain. It manages digestion, sure, but it also seems capable of learning and memory, sending signals up to the brain.
And then there's the whole gut-brain axis, the GBA.
Right, this constant two-way communication highway. And it's not just nerves. It involves the microbiome, the trillions of bacteria, fungi, viruses living in your gut.
Which might outnumber our own human cells.
Potentially.
Yeah.
And this gut ecosystem profoundly influences things like mood, anxiety, even depression. Stress impacts your gut bugs, and the chemicals those bugs produce impact your brain. It's deeply interconnected.
So gut feelings are real.
In a neurochemical sense, absolutely. But the gut isn't the only other player. Think about the heart.
The heart has neurons, too.
It does. About 40,000 of them in what's called the intrinsic cardiac nervous system. Its main job is fine-tuning your heartbeat, obviously. But research suggests this heart brain might also contribute to decision-making, memory, both short and long-term, and emotional processing.
Okay, gut. Heart. This is already expanding the picture, but then the sources took it even further, down to the cellular level, mitochondria.
Yeah, this one is maybe the most mind-bending. We all learn mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell, right?
Yeah.
They generate energy.
ATP, yeah, basic biology.
But they have their own DNA, separate from the cell nucleus. And the research we looked at suggests they might also function as tiny, distributed memory systems within each cell.
Wait, memory inside mitochondria? How?
They're calling the traces mitoengrams. These seem to be physical or chemical changes within the mitochondrial networks, perhaps triggered by stress or intense experiences. And these changes can persist, influencing how the cell functions and potentially even affecting brain function and cognition down the line.
So memory isn't just stored in brain synapses. It might be stored in the energy infrastructure of every cell in the body.
That's the implication.
Huh.
It suggests that intelligence, memory, maybe even some fundamental aspect of responsiveness or awareness isn't just in the brain or even the gut and heart, but is distributed throughout the entire physical system.
Okay, if that's even partially true, if intelligence is distributed across organs and even down to the cellular level, then the brain can't be the sole source of consciousness we thought it was.
It makes the brain look more like maybe the final integrator, or the part that generates the report we experience as consciousness.
Which fits that iceberg metaphor perfectly. Consciousness is the tiny visible tip. And all the really crucial work, the predictions, the interoceptive checks, the distributed memory, the gut and heart inputs, that's all happening unconsciously beneath the surface.
And this perspective helps make sense of those really puzzling medical cases, the ones that seem anatomically impossible.
Right, the hydrocephalus cases. People living with hardly any brain tissue because fluid has compressed it.
Yeah, there was that famous case in the 1980s of a university student with high honors in math, and another in 2007, a French civil servant. Both had their brains squeezed into just thin layers against the skull.
But they were conscious, functioning normally.
Remarkably so. High IQ, jobs, social lives. And then there was the woman discovered in 2014 who was born entirely without a cerebellum.
The part with more than half the brain's neurons.
The very same. And she lived a full, independent life. Mild motor difficulties, yes, but fully conscious, aware, navigating the world.
How is that possible if these massive brain structures are supposedly essential?
Well, these radical ideas we've been discussing offer possible explanations, don't they?
Okay, lay them out again.
Possibility one. The distributed cellular intelligence is real. Functional mitochondria across the body, maybe other cellular systems too, are maintaining essential cognitive functions and memory, compensating for the missing brain tissue.
So the body cells are doing the heavy lifting.
Or possibility two. Those second brains, the gut's ENS, the heart's nervous system, are playing a much, much larger role in synthesizing experience and enabling conscious awareness than we ever imagined. They're picking up the slack.
Or maybe it's the combination of both.
Very likely.
Uh-huh.
The point is, these cases strongly suggest the body itself is an integral part of the system that generates what we experience as consciousness. It's not just a vehicle for the brain.
That's a profound shift in thinking. So what are the practical takeaways? How does this change how we approach things like, say, mental health?
Well, one area highlighted in the sources is therapy, especially for trauma. It gives a strong theoretical basis for why somatic therapies can be so effective.
Somatic, meaning body-focused therapies.
Exactly. Therapies that work bottom-up, focusing on bodily sensations, releasing stored tension, processing how trauma feels in the body. This contrasts with traditional top-down talk therapy, which focuses more on thoughts and narratives.
Because if trauma and memory are stored physically, distributed through the body,
then just talking at it might not be enough, right? You need to address the information the body is holding on to, the mitoengrams of stress, the gut feelings of unsafety, the tension patterns. You have to work with the whole system.
It makes sense. If consciousness is the end result of this whole complex system, predictions, networks, signals from the gut, heart, cells, then our conscious awareness is really just the final output layer.
The tip of the iceberg, catching up to processes that have already occurred.
Which brings us to that final thought, sparked by the research showing we often make decisions before we're consciously aware of making them.
Uh-huh. The brain seems to commit to an action milliseconds before the subjective feeling of I decided kicks in.
So, if our consciousness is kind of lagging behind this vast unconscious body-based system, here's the provocative question for you listening. What practical steps can you take to better listen to those deeper unconscious bodily layers before they fully dictate your conscious choices?
How do you get better at tapping into the intelligence of the entire system, not just the final report?
Something to think about.